Our next speaker, who, take your water bottle up, Rick, or your wife will have to bring it.
Right here.
Is Rick Sturtevant, PhD. He joined the U.S. Air Force History and Museums Program in 1984 and has been Air Force Space Command Deputy Director of History since 1999. An internationally recognized authority on U.S. military space history, he appears frequently as a guest lecturer on aerospace history topics, and in addition to writing classified official histories, has published numerous book chapters, essays, articles, and reviews. He serves on the editorial board of Quest, the History of Spaceflight Quarterly, and is editor of the International Academy of Astronautics History Series. Sturtevant's professional honors include the Air Force Exemplary Civilian Service Award, the American Astronautical Society President's Recognition Award, and election as an AAS Fellow. Rick.
Thank you, Mike. And I'd like to thank Greg Atkins, who gave us a good introduction in his talk on boosterism and the founding of Fort Carson and now Peterson Air Force Base, then Pete Field, where one of my uncles, my mother's oldest brother, was one of the advanced people who came to set up that base in 1942. So in a way, what I'm going to talk about, and you might think about this, the military itself, Air Force senior leaders there at Pete Field, now Peterson Air Force Base, have become boosters in their own right. During the Space Command activation ceremony on the 1st of September 1982, its new and first commander, General James Hardinger, who you see there, on the parade ground at Pete Field, declared, "This is the place, these are the people, and we will make Colorado Springs the space capital of the free world." There was only one problem at that point. In September 1982, the command didn't have any space systems or any other kinds of systems assigned to it, which seemed a little strange at the time. All they had was a headquarters. Now, that's not to say that space-related missions hadn't been in Colorado Springs prior to 1982. Some of you are old enough to remember, I think, that back at Ent Air Force Base, as early as June 1961, the Air Force Space Surveillance Network was assigned to then Air Defense Command. And up in the upper right-hand corner, you see the Space Surveillance Center at Ent Air Force Base. Well, things went along. The responsibilities for the Space Surveillance Network grew. Worldwide sensors were sending data into the Space Surveillance Center here in Colorado Springs. And by 1966-67, the Cheyenne Mountain Complex had been completed, and in the underground center, a new Space Defense Center was built. There you see it in 1973. And so there was a tremendous responsibility for watching everything that was going on in outer space and cataloging a record of all of that. And Aerospace Defense Command was providing that data to the National Aeronautics and Space Administration for distribution to civilian and commercial organizations in the United States and around the world. Now, there was only one problem, and things were looking pretty good at that point. But in 1979, the Air Force leadership, in its infinite wisdom, decided that all of those sensors around the world and the surveillance network command center in Cheyenne Mountain would be transferred to Strategic Air Command at Omaha, Nebraska for management responsibility. And Aerospace Defense Command was inactivated, disestablished. That was at the end of December of 1979. So there was a three-year period when the responsibility for managing all these space surveillance assets didn't exist here in Colorado Springs, even though the function was ongoing here. Well, General Hardinger decided that he needed to campaign very hard to get those assets back. And we have a letter in our archives where he wrote to Benny Davis, the commander of SAC, in May of 1983. This is 9 months, full gestation period, after the command had been created here. And he said, "Benny, don't you think it's time you send those assets back for our control here?" It's a wonderful letter. and Davis did it. On the 1st of May, 1983, the assets came back for space surveillance around the world. First, the ballistic missile early warning system with bases at Thule, Greenland, Clear, Alaska, and Filingdales Moor, and dedicated space surveillance radars like the solid-state phased array at FPS 85 at Eglin, the FPS 79 in Peninsulic Turkey, looking out at Russia. Also, optical assets like the Baker-Nunn cameras that had been watching ever since Sputnik was launched in October of 1957, and the GEODS, which was an electro-optical upgrade to the Baker-Nunn capability, ground-based electro-optical deep space surveillance system. And also some space assets. The DSP satellites, Defense Support Program, up there 22,000 miles in space in geosynchronous orbit, looking down to try to detect any missile launches anywhere in the world. And the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, or DMSP, that had been invented originally to precede the Corona Reconnaissance Satellites in orbit, because we didn't want to take pictures of just cloud cover, right? We wanted to take pictures where we could see what the Soviets were doing with their weapon systems. And so the DMSP satellite would precede the Corona Reconnaissance Satellite and say, okay, well, weather's clear, we can take pictures. Or don't open the shutter and waste film. So all of those came to Space Command on the 1st of May, 83. And less than 3 weeks later, also 17 May, groundbreaking for the Consolidated Space Operations Center at what was then Falcon Air Force Station. We now know it as Schriever Air Force Base. You see General Hardinger there in the center with some of the civic leaders and some of the engineers breaking ground for the CSOC. Now the CSOC was to have two responsibilities. One was to command and control in orbit all of the existing military satellites and some new ones. And one of the new ones was the Global Positioning System, GPS. It was to have another responsibility. If some of you recall, by 1983, the space shuttle was flying. And the direction was that all U.S. launches, military, commercial, civil, would occur on NASA's space shuttle. And the thing had been designed with military requirements in mind, and the CSOC out at Falcon Air Force Station was supposed to have what was called the SOPC, the Shuttle Operations and Planning Complex. It was to be a military equivalent, direct duplicate actually, of the Johnson Space Center that NASA ran in Houston. And in fact, if the Houston Center went down, the SOPC could even do the civil missions for NASA and vice versa. So that was a big, a big thing we were looking forward to. Unfortunately, the Challenger accident in January of 1986 put a stop to that. The SOPC was only partially completed, and we didn't finish it. What went in there in its place, not run by us, was what we commonly know as Star Wars, the Strategic Defense Initiative Center. That was fine. We had the Space Surveillance Network. We had the Consolidated Space Operations Center underway. But in 1985, General Hardinger's successor, General Harries, decided that we needed to go after the control of satellites on orbit. That was another big mission responsibility for space operations. And so we did here in Colorado Springs what was called the Satellite Control Architecture Study. And it wasn't until 1987 that that campaign unfolded to the point where Air Force Space Command took over the Blue Cube, the Air Force Satellite Control Facility, Onizuka Air Force Base in Sunnyvale, California. And you can see they were still doing things manually there in that picture on the right. Now eventually, that was all going to come to what became Schriever Air Force Base in the upper left. And they would do telemetry tracking and control of all of our operational military satellites. Currently, there are a little over 150 satellites that we operate out of Schriever Air Force Base. And so that's a very important responsibility The woman in the picture there is a GPS satellite controller. And then we decided that we needed to go after space launch. So you had knowing what's up there in orbit, you had controlling what we have up there in orbit, and we wanted to go after the control of launching those things and the centers from which they're launched. You see Cape Canaveral there in that picture with two different kinds of rockets, evolved expendable launch vehicles for which Air Force Space Command was responsible under the leadership of General Tom Moorman. He did a Blue Ribbon study panel that led to those launch vehicles being developed well after the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up and we had to go back to expendable launch responsibilities. So that was 1990 that we got space launch in October. And so subsequently, when I talked to General Hardinger, as we approached the 10th anniversary of Space Command's activation, the general smiled and said in an interview, "I think we really have made Colorado Springs the space capital of the free world." But that wasn't all there was to it. That was a lot of space operations, right? But what about how we get to operate things in space? We have to acquire them. And so on the 1st of October 2001, it became Air Force Space Command's responsibility to oversee the Space and Missile Systems Center in Los Angeles, California. That's their new headquarters building there. And SMC is responsible, through our direction here in Colorado Springs, for procuring all of the launch vehicles and all of the space systems, satellites, and the subsystems, and the controlling systems that go into military space operations in the United States. Not just Air Force. We also do that for the other services, like the Navy and the Army as well. So you might say that by 2001, Air Force Space Command here in Colorado Springs had responsibility for space operations from cradle to grave. Now, I began to think about that, and what General Hardinger had meant was, well, you know, if we accumulate all these mission responsibilities, that means that we've become the all-powerful space leader, right? But there might be other ways to measure this thing. And I could suggest several, and I will in the paper when it's published by the Library District. But ask yourselves this question, and we'll talk about this for a couple minutes. Beyond military users, who benefits from Space Command's procurement and operation of space systems? Tracking space debris, that's happening. Space Surveillance Network, it's been run here ever since 61. We still do that, and we oversee it. It's done out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California now. But you can go online. There's a spacetrack.org, spacetrack.org website. You can become a subscriber, and you can go and you can see the status of the catalog. It's updated constantly, and it's kind of interesting. What does this do? It helps avoid collisions in space, especially between so-called space junk. There's a lot of it out there, 22,000 objects we're tracking in the catalog right now. And you don't want those colliding with active spacecraft especially. And it safeguards residents who are aboard the International Space Station right now. When the shuttle was flying, we even warned the shuttle astronauts, and they would sometimes maneuver to avoid pieces of space junk. When an especially large piece of junk looks like it's going to deorbit, we'll begin tracking that with special care, and we can predict when and where it's going to deorbit. That can be very important if it's going to deorbit over populated areas, right? So far, only one piece of space junk has ever hit anybody, and it was a little bit of foil that hit a woman. She was walking her dog in a park in Texas at 3 in the morning, so I'm not quite sure what she was doing out there. Another bit of this yardstick, remember the Defense Meteorological Satellites? They're in sun-synchronous orbits, and they've long been available to civil and commercial users as well as private individuals in terms of the data that they deliver. Not all of it, but some. Although our command still owns DMSP, on the 29th of May, 1998, it became the first military space system ever turned over operationally to a civil organization. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration now runs it on a daily basis, NOAA, and anyone can access a substantial amount of the DMSP data by going to the NOAA website, N-O-A-A, and then you'll have a hyperlink to DMSP. Defense meteorological satellites built for the early warning of launches from the Soviet Union of ICBMs. Well, when it was highly classified, we couldn't talk about this. We couldn't even say that the ground station is up at Buckley Air Force Base in Aurora, where it is. But after the first Gulf War in 1991, Tom Moorman said, we need to declassify that. We need to tell people other things that it can do. If it can detect the heat signatures from a rocket, what else might it detect? Volcanic eruptions, right? Or forest fires. This is a minute and a half scan of the area of Mexico in 1998 from DSP. And I got to thinking about that when that map was first published. What was happening along the Front Range here in Colorado? People were talking about this haze that was coming up along the Front Range, and we knew there weren't any fires in New Mexico or Arizona or Colorado at that point. It was smoke that was coming up from these fires. So here, with a strategic asset that was built primarily for Cold War purposes, we're able to get some civilian and commercial benefit. Ranchers can move things out of the way. People with asthma can take shelter, make sure their supply of oxygen is in good shape. And then there's the GPS. And a lot of people probably don't know that it's all operated right out of Schriever Air Force Base, but it is. On the 1st of May 2000, President Clinton declared GPS a global utility, and it's been fully operational since 1995. These are just some of the things that it's used for. There are a few more things. Millions of people worldwide rely on GPS intentionally or unknowingly, probably mostly unknowingly, every minute of every day, everywhere around the world. And it's a military system that actually is used commercially and civilly by more individuals than by the military. And yet we pay for it and we run it. So I would say, yes, perhaps Colorado Springs has become the space capital of the free world. Just 3 days ago, in fact, I read an article. It was an interview with Colonel John Shaw, commander of the 21st Space Wing, who's about to depart for Omaha for a U.S. Strategic Command assignment. And here's what he said in that interview. Colorado Springs is the space capital of the world. No, not the free world, the world. Sometimes it is missed what these groups here do on behalf of their country and the world with GPS and tracking space trash. It is something for the community to be aware and proud of.
So there was a man walking down the street and he'd made a hat out of tinfoil. And somebody said, why are you wearing a hat made out of tinfoil? And he said, well, I heard that there was a space object falling, and there was a 1 in 100 million chance that somebody could be hit. Imagine what the odds are of hitting someone wearing a tinfoil hat. That was a joke, come on. Our final presenter for this session is William Schultz. He's a graduate student in the Department of History at Princeton University. His dissertation, Garden of the Gods, Colorado Springs and the Origins of the Culture Wars, explores how the city of Colorado Springs became both a site and a symbol of the culture wars of the 1980s and 1990s. Prior to attending Princeton, he earned his BA in History and Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. William.
So my presentation is PowerPointless. Hopefully it will not be utterly pointless, but I will leave you to be the judge of that. I did have plans for a multimedia part of it, but then I found how expensive it is to rent a fog machine and a disco ball, even for just the space of one day. So I will just speak. So I'll start with the example of Warren Waddies, the Reverend Warren Waddies, and with a sermon that he delivered in 2004. Waddies told his congregation of the importance of evangelizing because he reminded them, those not born again will burn in the fires of hell. A strong message, to say the least, but not tremendously unusual for Waddies, given that he was a minister of the Four Square Gospel Church, a very conservative evangelical denomination. What was a little unusual was the venue. Waddies was not speaking at a Four Square Gospel Church. He was speaking to Air Force Academy cadets during Beast Camp, the grueling training that cadets have to undergo before attending the academy. Waddies in his sermon became Exhibit A for the people who were concerned and warned of the growing influence of evangelical Christianity at the Air Force Academy. Now, the case of Waddies was brought to light by Kristen Leslie, a professor at Yale Divinity School. She and a couple other graduate students from Yale had gone to Beast Camp to see whether the academy was making progress dealing with the issue of sexual assault. What they found instead was an atmosphere suffused with evangelical Christianity. Leslie and Melinda Morton, a chaplain at the academy, later wrote a memo to the chief chaplain at the Air Force Academy. They reported that Protestant cadets were encouraged to return to tents, proselytize fellow Beast members, and remind them of the consequences of apostasy. Leslie and Morton wrote warning that such stridently evangelical themes challenge the necessarily pluralistic environment of basic cadet training. The overwhelmingly evangelical tone of general Protestant worship encouraged religious divisions rather than fostering spiritual understanding among basic cadets. Now, Leslie and Morton's warning was not meant to be public, but it was made public by a man named Mikey Weinstein, who I see that has some name recognition here. Mikey Weinstein was an attorney, Air Force Academy graduate. His son had reported to him that there were cases of anti-Semitism at the academy. Was particularly concerned by an issue in which some cadets had placed flyers for a showing of Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ around the dining hall at the Air Force Academy. When Mikey Weinstein felt that the Air Force Academy was not responding quickly enough to his concerns, he compiled a list of evangelical incidents at the academy and then released that list to the Colorado Springs Gazette. Now, Weinstein's crusade made the question of religion at the Air Force Academy a national debate. There were no less than four separate investigations of the religious climate there, two of them sponsored by the Air Force. Congress held debates on the matter, during which one emotional congressman, angry at suggestions that evangelicals dominated the academy, declared, "Like moths to a flame, Democrats can't help themselves when it comes to denigrating and demonizing Christians." He was a Republican, as you can probably guess. But the question remains, why did the Air Force Academy become known as a bastion of evangelical Christianity, especially when compared to the other service academies? Now, given that this evangelical issue coincided with the war on terror, it's easy to explain it as a consequence of the presidency of the evangelical George W. Bush. But The story goes back much further than that, to the Academy's beginnings early in the 1950s. The Academy began as part of what one historian called the Cold War's spiritual industrial complex, a fusion of religious devotion and military might. And as the United States grew in some ways more secular into the 1960s and onward, and as the spiritual industrial complex of the 1950s crumbled in other places, some evangelicals at the Academy came to see themselves as stewards of this tradition. So it was not evangelicals taking over the Academy. It was some evangelical Christians co-opting what was already there and had been there since the start. Now, the Academy was born and baptized in the midst of a national religious revival. The decade after World War II was maybe the most pious moment in American history, at least if we judge by the numbers. You know, church attendance soared. Biblical epics like the Ten Commandments and The Robe were top-grossing movies, and millions of people tuned in to watch Roman Catholic Bishop Fulton Sheen on his television show, Life is Worth Living. Now, the United States government gave its stamp of approval to this revival, adding "Under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance and making "In God We Trust" the nation's official motto. President Dwight Eisenhower perfectly captured the spirit of the times when he said, "Our form of government makes no sense unless it is founded on a deeply felt religious faith, and I don't care what it is." Ike always had a way with words. The United States Air Force Academy was no exception. At the Academy's dedication in 1955, Secretary of the Air Force Harold Talbot told cadets, "I think it's right and proper to ask the blessing of God upon this Academy and upon you who enter it. I beg of all you young men of the air age that you never become so smart, so cynical, so impressed with the tremendous weapons you will control that you forget the only hand that is forever on your shoulder." This wasn't just empty talk, because religion was given literally concrete form at the Academy in the form of the 17-spired cadet chapel. Now, one Academy pamphlet described the chapel as the crowning architectural feature of the Academy campus. And indeed, Walter Netsch, the architect of the chapel, had designed the building to dominate the campus the way Gothic cathedrals had dominated the towns of medieval Europe. Building on the popular notion that the United States was a tri-faith nation, Netsch divided the chapel into Protestant, Catholic, and Jewish worship spaces. But reflecting the demographic reality of the cadets, the Protestant chapel was by far the largest of the three. And if you go there now, that's the one most people visit, the large one upstairs. The other two are in the basement. Religion was woven into the Academy's everyday life. On arriving, cadets had to declare a religious affiliation, Protestant, Catholic, or Jew, and then had to attend the weekly services of their faith of choice for the first 3 years on campus. There they heard messages like this from Protestant chaplain Colonel John Bennett. And it's worth noting that the chaplains were all military men as well. "Those of us who have dedicated our lives to the military service belong to God, our shepherd, and we belong to our country." The influence of the chaplains extended beyond Sunday, however. General Hubert Harmon, the founding father of the Academy, believed that the primary mission of chaplains was to develop a sense of religious and moral responsibility in each cadet. Chaplains thus took the lead in handling not only religious matters, but disciplinary ones. And any cadet who wanted to leave the Academy had to first consult with a chaplain. Now, the religious establishment at the Academy continued pretty much unchanged through the 1950s and 1960s, only to shatter abruptly in the 1970s. The American Civil Liberties Union had long sought to challenge the practice of mandatory chapel services, but whenever they raised the issue with military leaders, they were informed politely, and sometimes not so politely, to get lost. Terrence Finnegan, chief of chaplains for the Air Force Academy, responded to one letter from the ACLU by saying that the ideal military man must possess within himself those basic moral concepts upon which our civilization and nation were founded, and therefore chapel was essential. The ACLU, though, finally found several students at West Point and Annapolis to challenge the practice. And in the 1972 case, Laird v. Anderson, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled mandatory chapel attendance unconstitutional. Now, some evangelical Christians acted the fastest to pick up and reassemble the broken pieces of the spiritual industrial complex in the wake of this ruling. Evangelical ministries had been present at the campus for decades. The Officers Christian Fellowship with camps throughout Denver, throughout Colorado. The Navigators, headquartered in Colorado Springs, had had small ministries on campus starting in the 1960s. But the elimination of mandatory chapel gave these and other ministries a new opportunity to reach cadets. In the wake of Laird v. Anderson, the Academy's chaplains sought to reach cadets not through Sunday services, but through small group activities, Bible studies, coffee houses. By 1974, they reported that while attendance at Sunday services had declined, more students than ever were attending denominational services. And starting in the 1980s, the chaplains began to outsource the leadership of some of these small groups to evangelical ministries. The result was SPIRE, Special Programs in Religious Education, a series of religious programs, some administered by chaplains, some administered by groups, most often evangelical, like the Navigators or Campus Crusade for Christ. Now, the Air Force Academy was also touched by events going on in Colorado Springs at large. The city's reputation as Jesus Springs or the Evangelical Vatican has always been, I think, a little overblown. And anyone who has talked to me about my project for more than 2 minutes knows I can't shut up about that fact. But the fact does remain that in the 1980s and 1990s, a growing number of evangelical ministries and large churches, mega churches, if you will, began to call the city home. And some of them influenced the Air Force Academy. One was Focus on the Family, which moved here in 1991. James Dobson, founder and president of Focus, spoke at the Academy's campus a couple times, as at the 1993 baccalaureate service for the Protestants. Other Focus executives spoke at special Sunday services at the chapel. Jerry White of the Navigators and Jim Irwin of High Flight also appeared on campus to speak in various occasions, national prayer breakfasts, for instance. Churches were also involved. New Life, the megachurch founded by Ted Haggard, sent vans up to the chapel to bring cadets who were interested back to New Life for services. And when cadets left the campus for religious retreats, they most often went to property owned by evangelical ministries, like the Navigators or Young Life. Now, none of this is to suggest an active conspiracy, but it is to suggest that the Academy was not impervious to goings-on outside it. Now, by the 1990s, evangelical Christianity was firmly established as a force at the Academy. Beginning in December 1991, and recurring every Christmas thereafter, Christian Leadership Ministries, a division of Campus Crusade for Christ, ran an ad in the Academy Spirit declaring Jesus is the reason for the season, and asking cadets with questions about Jesus to speak to one of the 200 faculty, staff, faculty and officers who had signed the ad. A report prepared for the superintendent in 1994 spoke of notoriously fundamentalist Christian speakers on campus. And in 1997, a professor in the philosophy department wrote to the superintendent that the influence of conservative Christians at USAFA is close to violating the constitutional principles of separation of church and state. The leadership, however, ignored these warnings, especially as they themselves were growing more interested in bringing religion back into the academy. Bradley Hosmer, the superintendent of the academy early in the 1990s, even considered reinstating mandatory chapel as part of the character building program. He did not after he found that was illegal. Evangelicalism was thus a very powerful subculture at the academy, but it took a sexual assault scandal to push it to the forefront. In the early 2000s, it was revealed that leaders at the academy had downplayed and sometimes ignored cases of sexual assault. The scandal empowered evangelicals in two ways. First, it brought about a change in leadership that elevated Major General Johnny Wida, a devout evangelical Christian, to the position of commandant of cadets, a position he sometimes used to evangelize, as when he led students in a cheer of "Jesus rocks" at a public occasion. The other change was that the scandal changed the academy's culture. One observer remarked in the wake of the evangelization scandal, in a very direct way, the religious controversy at the academy was a continuation of the sexual assault scandal. Evangelicals were able to make a compelling case for stiffening the moral fiber of cadets. So this was what Kristen Leslie saw at Beast Camp, a powerful evangelical subculture that emerged from the remnants of the spiritual industrial complex to dominate religious life at the academy. And certainly not all, or even a majority, of evangelical Christians at the academy engaged in a sort of coercive proselytizing. But some did, and in an authoritarian, hierarchical atmosphere, like the Air Force Academy, it couldn't help but coloring the religious climate. And obviously, this still remains a very fraught issue today. I'm glad to report that I have come up with a solution which will solve all of the problems of religious freedom at the Academy. But unfortunately, I'm just about out of time, so I'll have to close there. And thank you very much.